This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip by Richard Rattay. Read by Jonathan Todd Ross. Chapter 1. Swerving Through the 70s. A Family Boldly Leaves Its Driveway. One winter evening in 1976, when I was 7 years old, I went to sleep in my bed in Wisconsin and woke up in a snowdrift in Indiana. I had little idea how I'd gotten there. I dimly recall my father's arms cradling me as I looked up through eyelids heavy with sleep. I watched the white ceiling of the hallway turn into the shadowy pine rafters of our garage, then the fuzzy tan fabric of our family car's interior. I remember being tossed across the laps of my older brothers in the back seat, a pillow pushed under my head, and a blanket thrown over my body. Then I drifted off again into blackness. Next came a startled yelp. I opened my eyes to find myself tumbling in a blur of stuffed animals, 8-track tape cartridges, styrofoam coffee cups, and issues of Dynamite magazine. I landed on the car's floor with a thud, the round hump of the transmission housing pressed into my belly, my chin burning from sliding on the shag carpet. I had no idea where we were, but I knew where we weren't. Anywhere near the sunny beach in Florida that I'd been listening to my mom tell us about for weeks. All I could surmise was that I was in our car, and it was cold and dark and eerily quiet. Even the engine was still. Finally, my dad's voice cut the silence. "Geez, Louise. Everyone okay? Anyone hurt?" my dad asked, his head swiveling around from my mom and sister beside him in the front seat to my brothers and me in the rear.
What happened?"
my mom replied, dazed. Like me, she'd just been roused from a deep sleep to find herself on a whirling carnival ride.
"Whoa, we did at least 3 360s. Gushed my 13-year-old brother Bruce, a little too enthusiastically for the rest of us.
"The highway just became a hockey rink," my dad explained. "Cars spinning everywhere. It's a wonder we didn't smack into anyone." My 12-year-old sister Leslie, who got motion sickness from riding escalators at the mall, didn't say a word. She just stared straight ahead in her usual position between my parents in the front seat, trying not to barf all over the dashboard. After counting heads to make sure none of us had been launched into orbit, my parents quickly assessed our situation. The car was upright, though pitched at an unnerving angle. Good. No one had any obvious fractures or gushing head wounds. Good. Not a single window showed a crack. Also good. The worst that could be said was that all of the loose contents inside our car, maps, thermoses, shoes, me, were scattered about as though our vehicle had been picked up and shaken like a snow globe. But then, that was how the inside of our car generally looked while on a road trip anyway. What was unusual was how dark it was. The only light inside our car streamed in shafts through gaps of thick snow caked on every window. Dad turned the ignition key. To our surprise, the engine roared to life, pressing the windshield wipers suddenly back into action. As they labored to push the clumps of snow aside, we got a better view of our predicament. Our car had come to rest well off the interstate, halfway down a broad slope that served as one side of a wide V-shaped highway median. Since I was only 7 years old, I didn't dwell on the delicate nature of our predicament. Instead, I thought about what a great sledding hill this would make. Had we been on Dad's prized wood toboggan and not inside our 1975 Lincoln Continental town car. We weren't alone. As far as we could see, ahead of us and behind, vehicles were scattered about the interstate like toy cars dropped by a cranky toddler. Dad pulled his door handle, allowing a ferocious blast of frigid air to swirl inside. The door barely budged, blocked by a mound of thigh-high snow outside. Dad's blood pressure instantly redlined. "Cripes, Jiminy!" It was one of many colorfully benign phrases he kept ready to avoid blurting out a real ear burner in front of us kids. Others included, "Gee willikers," for crying out loud, and his ever-reliable go-to non-expletive, "criminately." That they made no sense wasn't important. It was enough that they kept him out of the doghouse with my mom and the Catholic Church. Dad slammed the door back and forth against the snowdrift like a battering ram. This took no small effort. The door of a mid-70s Lincoln was only a slightly smaller version of the one guarding the entrance to a NORAD command bunker. Eventually, he cleared enough space to slip outside, and my mom turned off the engine. "There's no sense wasting gas," she said. "We may be here a while, and we'll need the heater." My mother was nothing if not practical. "Now, did any of you happen to pack candy bars or anything else to eat?" We hadn't been stuck in the ditch 5 minutes, and my mom was already formulating a rationing scheme to improve our chances of survival. If raising 4 kids had taught her anything, it was to always prepare for the worst. Mom and my brothers also began to piece together the morning's events. As usual, we'd left our home in suburban Milwaukee hours before daybreak. Getting an early start was critical. We had to get through Chicago before rush hour, or we'd lose 2 hours just crawling from one side of the city to the other. Dad's strategy was to pack the car the day before our departure. Then, promptly at 3 a.m. the following morning, he'd storm through the house, flipping on lights and hollering orders like a drill sergeant at reveille. As the baby of the family, and the one most likely to cause a delay, I was simply scooped from my bed, still clutching my beloved blankie, and carried out. Dad would deposit me in the back seat, jump behind the wheel, and we'd be off in a cloud of leaded gas fumes. We'd be 100 miles from home before any of us were really conscious enough to grasp what had happened. However, that morning, my oldest brother, 15-year-old Mark, had remained awake. He recounted for the rest of us how the miles had passed uneventfully at first, and how we'd even made it through Chicago in record time. But as we crossed Illinois into Indiana, it had begun to snow, and the light flurry quickly whipped into a raging squall. As we reached an exposed stretch of interstate south of Gary, Indiana, whiteout conditions slowed traffic to a crawl. But not slow enough, it turned out. Whipping winds had polished the moist pavement into a sheet of black ice. And without warning, a car ahead of us went into a spin. Trying to avoid a collision, trailing drivers hit their brakes, sending them into swirls of their own. "Almost miraculously," Mark continued, "no vehicles collided. Instead, each found its way into the snowy sloping median on one side of the interstate or down the steep embankment on the other. Of course, he couldn't be sure. We'd been busy spiraling into a ditch of our own." The driver's door popped open and my dad clambered inside, his face red with cold. I talked to a trucker with a CB down the road. He said a fleet of wreckers are on the way. With any luck, we'll be back on the road in a couple hours. So we waited. 6 of us huddled in a jumbo road barge beached on a highway median, waist-deep with snow. We'd all just been nearly killed in a horrible crash in nowhere, Indiana. We'd have to endure hours of delay before reaching our hotel, and its pool and game room, that evening. We had no smartphones, no DVD players, no iPods to keep us entertained. Those were all years, even decades, from invention. In our remote location, we couldn't even find a radio station signal strong enough to get the local news. Really, we had nothing except each other. Years later, we'd all agree it was the best start to a family road trip ever. If there was ever a time Americans needed a vacation, it was the 1970s. Nearly everyone had a good reason to pack up their station wagon or VW minibus and leave it all behind. The gloomy conclusion to the war in Vietnam had sent morale plummeting, while race riots taking place across the country kept tensions high. Unemployment and inflation skyrocketed, and remained elevated so long that economists had to coin a whole new term for the phenomenon: stagflation. All the term really meant was that although the 70s also gave us great new things like backyard hot tubs, home VCRs, and countertop microwave ovens, fewer people could afford them. The pressure of making ends meet also helped push the traditional nuclear family into meltdown. The number of divorces filed in 1975 doubled that of a decade earlier. Couples who did stay together had fewer children. The U.S. birth rate plunged to its lowest level since the Great Depression, half that of the baby boom years. Even the government appeared to be falling apart. Just years into the decade, first a vice president and then a president were forced to resign amid allegations of corruption. And hardly anyone placed much faith in the officials who remained. Not even a night at the movies offered much escape. In keeping with the sour mood, many popular movies of the 70s centered on disasters, demons, and dark conspiracies. Audiences were trapped in the towering inferno, or booked on a doomed flight in any of three airport movies. If you avoided being swallowed up by the ground in an earthquake, you might be devoured by the jaws of a great white shark. The Exorcist offered a hell of a fright. And if the devil didn't get you, the government would, even if it took all the president's men. If you somehow managed to avoid all that, you could still be subjected to Linda Blair shaking her booty in Roller Boogie. It's hard to say which fate was most horrifying. Things got so bad that Americans tried just about anything to find relief. From joining the Moonies, a controversial religious movement blending teachings of many faiths, nicknamed for its founder, Sun Myung Moon, to disco dancing, to learning to macrame. They were desperate times indeed. All things considered, it isn't surprising that many people, including my parents, decided the best plan was simply to sit out as much of the 70s as possible at some distant beach, historic battlefield, or theme park. Anywhere but home. Despite the flagging economy, Americans continued taking vacations throughout the 70s in record numbers, just as they had since the close of World War II. Thanks to two decades of prosperity, increasingly generous terms of employment, and broader acceptance of the benefits of taking time off from work, more Americans than ever before were able to escape the daily grind, if only for a couple of weeks each year. In fact, 80% of working Americans took vacations in 1970, compared to just 60% two decades earlier. As a result, attendance at national parks, historic sites, and other attractions surged 20 to 30% every year until 1976. Only then did the decade's second major fuel crisis force many families to pull the plug on their trip to see Old Faithful, or halt their march to the Gettysburg battlefield. To reach these far-off places, my family, like most others, traveled by car. It wasn't that we enjoyed spending endless hours in prison together in a velour-upholstered cell, squabbling over radio stations and inhaling each other's farts. It's that we had no other choice. Air travel had always been too expensive for anyone not named Rockefeller, or traveling on the company dime, much less a pair of middle-class parents taking four kids to the beach. Adjusted for inflation, a domestic plane ticket in the 70s cost 2 to 3 times the price of the same ticket today. Given the cost, it shouldn't be too surprising, and yet still is, that as late in 1975, 4 in 5 Americans had never traveled by plane. Not for a weekend getaway to Las Vegas, not to head off to college, not for a once-in-a-lifetime honeymoon in Paris, never. Although ordinary Joes couldn't afford a plane ticket, nearly every family could afford a car, often two. If there was one thing America was very good at, it was producing automobiles. Following World War II, American car factories needed only to do some quick retooling to go from churning out airplanes and tanks to cranking out cars faster than ever. And thanks to a booming economy, Americans could afford to buy all those shiny new cars as fast as they rolled off assembly lines. By 1972, the number of cars on the nation's roads exceeded the number of licensed drivers, inviting the troubling thought that many cars were simply driving themselves around. What's more, Americans loved to get behind the wheel. During the 1970s alone, Americans logged 14.4 trillion highway miles, enough to travel from Earth to Pluto and back 2,500 times. To be sure, most travelers selected closer destinations, as there are so few decent hotel options along that route even today. My family alone was responsible for approximately 1 trillion of the miles logged by travelers in the 70s. At least that's how it seemed to me. As the youngest of four kids, I was the one relegated to the back seat, rear window shelf, or rear cargo compartment of a series of fine American automobiles purchased by my father over the course of the decade. Together, we toured the country. Well, half of it anyway. We rarely traveled west of the Mississippi, in week-long journeys taken 2 and sometimes 3 times a year. We were hardly pioneers, of course. By the time we got rolling on our family road trips, Americans had already been beating a well-worn path to the Grand Canyon and sunny beaches of Florida for more than half a century. But for much of that time, and in many areas of the country, the routes those motorists took were often little more than dirt tracks. Even in populated areas, drivers often had to pick their way through a confusing maze of privately owned turnpikes and poorly constructed two-lane highways built simply to connect one town to the next. It wasn't until well after World War II that America got serious about making long-distance road travel fast, safe, and convenient. That's when the country began rolling out the first of its mighty interstates, the so-called superhighways. The interstates were marvels of a modern era, unlike any roads Americans had traveled before. These high-speed highways weren't narrow and hemmed in by trees and tall buildings. They were wide and broad-shouldered, with huge swaths cleared on both sides to invite in sunshine and blue sky. What's more, they were elevated well above the surrounding terrain, affording drivers and passengers a panoramic view of the landscape. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about the interstates was the way they instantly made the country seem so much smaller. Suddenly, it was possible to travel from one state to the next, and even one coast to the other in a fraction of the time it once took. Places many Americans could once only read about in newspapers, or see pictures of in magazines, were now all within reach, given a reliable car and enough cash for fuel. What's more, the whole family could come along. In an automobile, 4 or 5 people could travel nearly as cheaply as one. Making things even nicer for my family, many of the interstates had been around long enough by the 1970s for an ample number of restaurants, gas stations, motels, and other conveniences to sprout up along their sides. By and large, we could count on exits with such services at regular intervals, allowing us the opportunity to fill our tank, grab a bite to eat, or rush in to take a quick potty as needed. At the time, my siblings and I took all of these things for granted. It seemed like they'd been around forever. Of course, we were young. Compared to us, it all had been around forever. The reality couldn't have been further from the truth. Like any destination worth reaching, it took considerable time and effort to make everything that went into those great road trips possible. It took the relentless determination of a long list of pioneers to plan and build the roads, highways, and interstates that allowed my family, and maybe yours too, to motor across the expanse of our country and go anywhere we pleased. It took the raw courage of a handful of daredevils to blaze the trails those road builders would follow. And it took the boundless ingenuity and quirky ideas of a long list of clever innovators and dogged entrepreneurs to create what we remember and think of today as the Great American Road Trip Experience. After all, somebody had to be crazy enough to be the first to try to drive a car across the country. Somebody had to chart the first roadmaps, open the first motel chains, and cut the first drive-through window into the side of a hamburger joint. Somebody had to come up with nifty gadgets, like the police radar gun. Boo! The Fuzzbuster! Yay! The CB, cruise control, and the 8-track tape deck. Somebody had to decide if it was just fine for precocious 7-year-olds like me to roam around the car, and even sprawl out across the rear window shelf, completely unrestrained. Somebody had to create the first station wagon. Then somebody else had to come along years later, look at a perfectly fine brand new design, and say, "You know what that model needs? Some fake wood paneling on the sides." So who were these somebodies? Where did they find the inspiration for all these ideas? How did everything we remember and love about those great road trips come to be? And why don't many families seem to take those long road trips together anymore? Make yourself comfy. We've got some serious ground to cover along the seldom-traveled back roads of America's history. Fascinating stories await. Chapter 2. Pioneers of the Pavement. The Long Road to the Interstates. Like Stonehenge, the Pyramids of Giza, and Mick Jagger, the U.S. interstate highway system is one of those marvels that seems to have been around forever. The reality is quite the contrary. In fact, a short list of the notable items that have been around longer than our first interstate includes electronic computers, the Burger King Whopper, optic fiber, videotape recorders, wireless TV remote controls, microwave ovens, Disneyland, nuclear submarines, diet soft drinks, Ritalin, credit cards, the Chevy Corvette, NBC's Today Show, ultrasound, color TV, the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, Playboy magazine, Marshmallow Peeps, and actor-singer-lifeguard David Hasselhoff. Even police radar guns have been around longer than our interstate system, which just goes to show that the odds have been stacked against drivers from the very beginning. In fact, at the time my family was spinning off into medians in the 1970s, most superhighways were scarcely more than a decade old. That's not to say America didn't have plenty of roads. Depending on how loosely one defines the term, roads had been around since the first colonial settlements. But because our country is so young, so huge, and so generously endowed with every type of obstacle to road construction, perilous mountain ranges, mighty forests, yawning canyons, baking deserts, boundless plains, impenetrable swamps, and rampaging rivers, America would lag far behind other nations in the development of a coordinated system of high-speed highways to connect its sprawling expanse. As one might expect, the tale of how our modern highway system came to be is long, winding, and fraught with detours, potholes, and dead ends. But to understand why things are the way they are is a trip well worth taking. The path to America's superhighways began with exactly that, paths, or rather narrow Indian trails trampled down by horse and foot traffic. As cities started to be built in the new colonies, farmers and lumbermen in outlying areas clamored for local governments to fund King's Highways, wide enough to accommodate wagons, so they could more easily bring their goods to market. But the French and Indian War, and then the American Revolution, brought road building to a halt. There was no money or workers to spare for anything but the war efforts. It wasn't until 1795 that Americans were able to set foot, horse hoof, or carriage wheel on anything truly resembling a paved long-distance road. Stretching 62 miles between the cities for which it is named, the Philadelphia and Lancaster Turnpike was the country's first major engineered road. The engineering consisted of leveling the ground and covering the surface with a layer of crushed gravel. In exchange for a toll, a turnpike keeper would rotate a spiked gate, or pike, allowing the paying traveler passage to the next turnpike down the road. Because the road was constructed by private investors hoping to make a profit, the state of Pennsylvania avoided the burden of financing a major project. However, provisions in the Turnpike's charter gave the state the right to oversee its operation. The arrangement worked well enough that more private companies began building similar toll roads in other populated areas of the country. Public road building took far longer to gain traction. At the turn of the 19th century, America was a young country with many needs. Schools, government buildings, prisons, public health facilities, and a military, to name just a few. And government was hard-pressed to fund it all. And roads were expensive. It cost between $1,500 and $2,000 per mile to construct a road at a time when a skilled craftsman might make $1.50 a day, and a laborer half as much. Federal funding of roads faced an additional obstacle, the U.S. Constitution. The founding document merely granted government the power to regulate commerce among the several states and establish post offices and post roads. Exactly what constituted a post road had yet to be determined. For these reasons, few public roads were constructed, and even fewer remained passable in all but ideal conditions. Rainstorms regularly turned roads to knee-deep mud. As the roads dried out, passing horses and carriages left deep ruts that the sun baked into treacherously jagged surfaces. It made for a rough and dangerous ride. One of the most notorious of these roads was the 53-mile route from Fredericksburg, Virginia to Washington, D.C., the route Thomas Jefferson traveled on his frequent commute from Monticello. Following one particularly bone-jarring ride, an exasperated Jefferson declared the road the worst in the world and vowed to get Congress to commit federal money to improve public thoroughfares. The fact that he was the sitting president of the United States considerably helped his chances. At Jefferson's prodding, Congress passed the Enabling Act of 1802. Along with establishing the state of Ohio, the act provided a faster way for aspiring settlers to get there. For the first time, federal money was spent constructing a highway, setting an important precedent. The route would be known first as the Cumberland Road, and later the National Road. Hundreds of immigrant workers were hired to dig a bed 60 feet wide and up to 18 inches deep, which was filled with crushed rock to form a level surface. The highway offered fast and reliable travel for wagon and horse traffic. In doing so, the National Road opened a gateway to the west for thousands of prospective settlers. Their journeys could very well be considered America's first road trips. However, the momentum to build better roads would stall. In 1812, America found itself in another war with Great Britain, consuming the country's limited resources. After the conflict, the nation devoted itself to more promising means to expedite trade with its western reaches. Canals to connect its many segregated waterways and railroads. With the success of the Baltimore and Ohio Line, the B&O of Monopoly Game Board fame, and the first transcontinental railroad, America became obsessed with building railways and road construction fell by the wayside. Even funds to maintain existing roads dried up. By the mid-1800s, even the National Road, once America's mighty highway to the west, had fallen into disuse and disrepair. It would be nearly a century before America would resume rolling out roads with any resolve. The catalyst would be a wheeled conveyance, though not the one you likely expect. It was the bicycle, not the automobile, that would spur demand for better roads. By the late 1800s, bicycles were nothing new. In fact, they'd been around in some form for centuries. It just took a while for them to evolve into anything resembling a practical means of transportation. It wasn't until 1864 that anyone even got around to attaching pedals. Before then, riders powered their contraptions by running their feet along the ground while seated, the same way Fred Flintstone propelled his engineless car. The introduction of the safety bicycle in the late 1880s changed everything. The bicycle's revolutionary design shifted the position of the pedals from the front wheel to beneath the rider, which permitted riders to power the rear wheel instead of the front, using a treadle and later a chain. The modification eliminated the need for the huge front wheel of the penny farthing, so named because the model's tiny rear wheel resembled the small penny and farthing coins of the day, allowing riders to sit much lower, between two equal-size wheels, with their feet in easy reach of the ground. This configuration made riding a bicycle much safer, hence its name. At a stroke, safety bicycles transformed bicycling from a risky sport for daring young men to a practical form of transportation and leisure activity for riders of all ages, and both genders. People bought bikes in droves. By 1895, Americans owned nearly 10 million bicycles, one for every 7 people. The only problem was that there weren't enough good roads on which to ride them. With the sport's popularity booming,
Bicycling clubs, such as the League of American Wheelmen, popped up across the country. A main goal of these clubs was to promote construction of new and better roads on which bicyclists could ride their contraptions. Bicycle enthusiasts who had been across the Atlantic shared stories with fellow club members of the endless number of smoothly paved roads in and around major European cities, roads built by public funding. American bicyclists wanted the same for their own country. To press their case, they allied themselves with other groups seeking better roads, including farmers who still wanted better roads for their produce wagons, engineers, journalists, and health advocates. What bonded better roads and better health? Manure. In turn-of-the-century America, horses and horse-drawn conveyances were the primary means of transportation. Cities were packed with horses. 200,000 were stabled in New York City alone. On average, a horse produces 24 pounds of manure each day. That means horses were dropping nearly 5 million pounds of manure on New York City streets every day, creating dreadfully unsanitary conditions. Health professionals supported the construction of paved roads because it encouraged wider use of bicycles, and later automobiles, replacing horses that filled streets with piles of filth. Also, consider that people who work in the health field wear a lot of white clothing. The Good Roads Movement was off and running. To enlist public support, Good Roads groups held conventions and demonstrations and published books and magazines promoting roads. By the late 1890s, the movement had tallied significant victories. New Jersey became the first state to invest in road construction, and others followed. Soon the federal government was pushed into exploring ways to improve and expand the nation's highway system. But just as the bicycle was helping the Good Roads Movement gain traction, another conveyance was about to shift the effort into a higher gear. Brothers Charles and Frank Duryea weren't your ordinary bicycle makers. Charles, the older of the two, was known for producing bikes of peculiar design. One of his early creations featured a huge wheel in back and a much smaller one in front, which the rider moved to steer using levers beside his seat. Duryea called it the Sylph. A bemused colleague called it Freak. Soon the brothers began disappearing into a garage in Springfield, Massachusetts to tinker with a new idea. Inspired by the recent invention of the internal combustion engine, Charles fixed on the idea of using the device to power a modified horse buggy. Frank, the more talented engineer of the two, went to work on making it a reality. Toiling away 10-hour days, he worked through various problems with ignition, carburation, and transmission. After a year's labor, the pair parted the doors of the garage to reveal their revolutionary motor wagon, the first American gasoline-powered vehicle. A newspaper account of the machine's demonstration in September 1893 enthralled the public. It was the beginning of America's long love affair with the automobile. The Duryea brothers founded the first company to commercially produce automobiles in the United States and rolled 13 gleaming motor wagons out of their garage in 1896. That same year, a 33-year-old engineer working for Thomas Edison in Detroit unveiled his own self-propelled vehicle, which he dubbed the quadricycle. His name was Henry Ford. Encouraged by Edison, Ford tinkered with ways to improve his design and soon started his own company. A decade later, Ford began mass producing the Model T, the car that brought automobile ownership within reach of the common man. It's worth noting that the world's first automobile accident also occurred in 1896. While whipping through the streets of New York City in his Duryea motor wagon, a driver named Henry Wells slammed into a bicyclist, who suffered a broken leg. The incident was all too symbolic. The golden era of bicycling was about to be broadsided by the age of the automobile. So as America entered the 20th century, it would be auto enthusiasts, not bicyclists, who would drive the campaign for better roads. Like bicyclists, they formed clubs and rallied public support. The American Automobile Association, AAA, was formed in 1902. In large part to organize efforts promoting better roads and highways. But the organization faced an uphill climb. Mass production had yet to bring down the price of automobiles, meaning that car ownership was still limited to the well-to-do. Also, most Americans felt government shouldn't involve itself in building roads. Something more was needed to capture the imagination of the public and stir the demand for better roads. That something would be a series of daring attempts to cross America by car, from coast to coast, sea to shining sea. The nation had no shortage of daredevils ready for the challenge. But a cross-country road trip through a land without roads? Things were about to get interesting. The first noteworthy attempt to take a road trip across America began, as many ill-advised feats do, on a bet. While visiting California in 1903, a 31-year-old physician named Horatio Jackson accepted a friend's invitation to join him for a drink at San Francisco's University Club. It was there, over a cocktail, or likely several, that Jackson found himself embroiled in debate with another gentleman on the topic of whether automobiles were the future of transportation or merely a passing fad, with Jackson arguing vehemently in their favor. As the discussion grew livelier, Jackson boldly asserted that automobiles were already so rugged and reliable, he could drive a car clear across the country back to his home in Vermont. Predictably, Jackson was challenged to prove his contention, and a wager was set. $50, about $1,200 in today's money. Jackson wasn't fazed by the amount. He was wealthy. Nor was he dissuaded by the fact that he didn't own a car, had barely ever driven one, or that scarcely any roads existed west of the Mississippi. But he may have regretted having to explain the bet to his young wife the following morning. Rather than joining her husband on his adventure, she opted to take a train home instead. Undaunted, Jackson made his preparations. He hired a young mechanic, Sewell Crocker, to serve as his backup driver and traveling companion. On Crocker's advice, Jackson purchased a 2-cylinder 20-horsepower Winton touring car. Jackson named the car Vermont after his home state and the destination he hoped to reach. Together, Jackson and Crocker planned a route heading north before proceeding east along the Oregon Trail. Their aim was to avoid the treacherous Rocky Mountains and baking deserts of the Southwest that had doomed earlier attempts to cross the country by car. The pair then loaded the Winton with all manner of gear. Sleeping bags, blankets, canteens, overcoats, watertight rubber suits, water bag, axe, shovel, telescope, tools, spare parts, cans for extra gasoline and oil, rifle, shotgun, pistols, and a pulley system they could use to extricate themselves should they get stuck in mud. On May 23, 1903, Jackson kissed his bemused wife goodbye, and he and Crocker set off. Things didn't start smoothly. Only 15 miles into their journey, the car blew a tire. On the second night, the men realized the Winton's side lanterns weren't nearly bright enough to light their way after dark, so they purchased a large spotlight to mount on the hood. Near Sacramento, they were given bad directions, on purpose, by a woman because she wanted her family to get their first look at an automobile. The detour added 108 miles to their route. In Oregon, the pair suffered two more flats. Lacking spares, they wound thick rope around the wheels as a makeshift substitute until they could find new tires. Not long afterward, they ran out of fuel. Jackson rented a bicycle and pedaled 25 miles to purchase gas, then rode back with four heavy cans strapped to his back. Along the way, the bicycle blew a tire. And all this was before the twosome had even departed the West Coast. By the time Jackson and Crocker reached Idaho, news of their quest was beginning to spread. Their fame was bolstered by Jackson's decision to pick up another traveling companion, a spunky pit bull named Bud. While driving across the arid salt flats of Utah, the dog's eyes became so irritated by dust that Jackson had Bud fitted for his own driving goggles. The press ate it up, taking pictures of the three travelers and interviewing them at every stop. Jackson, Crocker, and Bud became national celebrities. After reaching Nebraska, the quality of the roads improved. And so did the adventurer's luck. Finally, on July 26, 1903, after 63 days on the road, and off it, the Vermont and its exhausted crew rolled into New York City,
completing the first successful crossing of the North American continent by automobile. Yet even as Jackson and his companions were completing their historic feat, a man named Charles Glidden was preparing to top it. Glidden's goal wasn't merely to cross America. It was to encircle the globe, by car, at a time when even developed countries offered few reliable roads. It was, to say the least, an outrageously ambitious proposition. But then Glidden was an outrageously ambitious man. By the time he was just 20 years old, he was already a rising star in the telegraph industry. When he saw a demonstration of Alexander Graham Bell's new telephone, he immediately recognized its potential. Striking up a partnership, Glidden and Bell developed technology that allowed existing telegraph lines to carry voice transmissions. His investment of his life savings in the construction of new telephone lines and exchanges made him millions. When the automobile came along, Glidden quickly jumped aboard it as well. He believed the automobile would fundamentally change the way people traveled in the same way the telephone had changed the way they communicated. As Glidden saw it, just two things were needed: public confidence in the reliability of cars and a network of good roads. He hatched a plan to inspire both. In 1901, he sold his telephone business and set off to drive a car around the world. Of course, Glidden's plan had to account for certain practical realities. Oceans, for one thing. He couldn't drive over them, so he shipped his automobile over water where necessary. He also realized that the rainy season in certain regions would make many roads impassable, so Glidden decided to travel in stages over several years, from 1902 to 1906. He'd conquer one continent or region one season, return home to wait out the bad weather, then pick up the following year where he had left off. Finally, Glidden promised to send the Boston Globe and other major newspapers regular updates and photos, allowing millions of readers to join him on his adventure. With much ballyhoo, Glidden set off from London in a British-made Napier with his wife Lucy and Charles Thomas, a skilled engineer. Thomas's grandson, Andrew M. Jepson, provides a thoroughly entertaining account of the intrepid motorist's journey in his 2013 book, Around the World in a Napier: The Story of Two Motoring Pioneers. Over the course of their travels, Glidden and his companions drove past the pyramids of Giza and through the gates of Jerusalem. They summited Afghanistan's Khyber Pass and penetrated the Arctic Circle. They scaled grades as steep as 20% in Japan and encountered cannibals in Fiji. They traveled into areas where the natives had never seen a car, much less even fathomed such a machine. Where there were passable roads, Glidden drove them. Where there weren't, Charles Thomas swapped out the vehicle's standard wheels for special flanged designs that allowed the car to drive on railroad tracks. Interestingly, Glidden was forced to drive on rails through most of the western United States, which he deemed one of the largest areas in the world without good roads. In 1904, he traveled from Minneapolis to Vancouver entirely by rail. Throughout the expedition, Glidden remained dressed impeccably, in suit and tie, knowing the eyes of the world, and the press, were always on him. The trip was, of course, one giant publicity stunt. Being the brilliant promoter he was, Glidden did something even more amazing when he completed his journey. He circled the world again. In total, Glidden's epic road trip covered 46,528 miles, nearly twice the equatorial circumference of the Earth, and passed through 39 countries, all without benefit of a single drive-through where he could pick up a quick burger and fries. Back in the States, car companies and drivers began a prolonged competition to set new records for crossing America by automobile. In 1909, Maxwell Briscoe sponsored the first cross-country attempt by a woman. The company believed that if Americans saw that even a woman, gasp, could accomplish the feat in a Maxwell automobile, it would prove its product's reliability beyond a doubt. The idea of a woman even riding in a car was controversial at the time. One physician went so far as to declare that automobile travel could result in dire health consequences for women, writing, "A speed of 15 to 20 miles per hour in a motor car causes women acute mental suffering, nervous excitement,
and circulatory disturbances. This might be true. My wife tells me she has experienced all these symptoms in a car I'm driving. To attempt the feat, the company chose Alice Ramsey, the mechanically inclined 22-year-old daughter of a ship's captain. At one point, the scrappy Ms. Ramsey jerry-rigged a fix for a broken axle well enough to drive several miles to a town where a new one could be installed. She completed the journey in 59 days, improving on Jackson and Crocker's mark by more than a week. A short time later, Bobby Hammond made the same trek from San Francisco to New York, in a record-smashing 6 days. Yet even his record didn't survive the year. Each daring crossing generated loads of publicity. And with it, the campaign for improved roads gained momentum. With good roads in America in short supply, it's hardly surprising there was also a scarcity of good road maps, or even a reliable system for numbering and marking roads. Even in the populated eastern states, the only guide to help drivers navigate the tangled web of dirt roads and trails was a series of dubious guides called Blue Books that offered brief descriptions or photographs of landmarks for drivers to look for along their route to direct them where to make turns. "Head north until you cross the trickling creek and look for a trail leading into a sunny prairie," read one entry. Another advised, "To travel in the direction of Baltimore, turn left at the fork with the fallen pine." In other words, if the landscape changed in even some small way due to a drought or ambitious beaver, drivers could become hopelessly lost. A decade into the new century, the good roads movement was picking up speed. The bicycle craze had gotten things rolling, the automobile accelerated support, and the success of a handful of intrepid drivers in crossing the country, even circling the world, by automobile, demonstrated the potential for long-distance travel by car. America was ready to start building a system of roads and highways to connect its distant ends. All that was needed was someone to help pave the way. Carl Fisher hardly seemed destined for success. He was the second of three sons born to a hard-drinking country lawyer and his long-suffering wife in tiny Greensburg, Indiana, in 1874. Fisher's mother, Ida, soon decided she'd had enough. Taking the children, she moved 40 miles to Indianapolis in hopes of finding work that would allow her to support the family on her own. Fisher wasn't much of a student. He suffered from astigmatism so severe it prevented him from reading the blackboard. Eventually, he gave up trying. Fisher quit school at the age of 12, taking a job packing groceries to supplement the family's income. Work taught Fisher more than he ever learned in school, especially when he took a job as a news butcher, hawking newspapers, tobacco, and candy at the Indianapolis train station. He learned he had a natural gift for convincing people to buy whatever he had to sell. Soon, he'd squirreled away $600, a substantial sum. At the same time, he became swept up in the bicycling wave, enthralling the country. Resolved to marry his talent for sales and passion for cycling, Fisher, at just 17 years old, convinced his brothers to join him in opening a bicycle shop in 1891. Things were tough at first. The Fisher brothers couldn't afford much inventory. They kept the doors open repairing flats at 25 cents a pop, literally. But Fisher was as driven to succeed as he was fanatical about bike racing. As a member of the local Zig Zag Cycling Club, Fisher's competitive streak stood out even among his teammates. They took to calling him Crip, short for cripple, because Fisher's risky maneuvers often resulted in spectacular crashes, leaving him battered and bloodied, but always ready for more. Using that same determination, Fisher somehow convinced Ohio's leading bicycle manufacturer to supply him a substantial amount of merchandise solely on credit. Still, Fisher had no money for advertising, so he embarked on a series of increasingly outlandish stunts to capture attention and draw customers into his shop. He built a 20-foot-tall high-wheel bicycle to ride through the streets of downtown Indianapolis. He released 1,000 balloons into the skies over the city, 100 of them containing certificates for free bicycles. He even strung a tightrope between two downtown buildings and rode a bicycle between them as a thrilled crowd 12 stories below watched. The stunts worked, and Fisher's shop thrived. By the age of 19, he owned the largest bicycle store in the city. But Fisher realized that bicycles were being overtaken in popularity by faster and more thrilling machines, automobiles. Fisher himself purchased what was likely the first automobile in Indianapolis, a French-made 2.5-horsepower De Dion Bouton. He transformed his bicycle shop into an automobile dealership, possibly the first in America, and began selling cars using the same wild promotional tactics he had used so successfully selling bikes. Once, he showcased the durability of the automobiles he sold by pushing a 7-passenger car off the top of a tall city building. When the car came to rest on the street below, one of Fisher's brothers hopped in the driver's seat and drove off, as an amazed crowd of onlookers cheered and followed along back to Fisher's dealership. At least, that's what many believed happened. Considering Fisher's considerable flair for showmanship, it's likely a little chicanery, and an identical second car, was involved. Bigger things lay in store for Fisher. In 1904, he was approached to help market a patented process that used compressed gas to illuminate automobile headlamps. The new system offered a substantial improvement over the dim kerosene lamps in current use, the same kind that had frustrated Horatio Jackson and Sewell Crocker. With a friend, Fisher founded Prestolite, a company that would become the leading supplier of headlamps in the United States. As head of Prestolite, Fisher made millions and developed friendships with top auto executives and politicians. Joining a handful of other Indianapolis businessmen, Fisher invested in another project, a grand racetrack constructed just outside the city. Intended to test and showcase the auto industry's newest and fastest cars, the track eventually became known as the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. However, the legendary venue's 1909 debut would be marked by tragedy rather than cheers. The problem was the track's surface of loose gravel and tar. During that first race, the inferior material crumbled under the stress of the car's maneuvering. Large chunks of rock were hurled in every direction. Before the race could be halted, dozens of onlookers were injured, and 6 people, including 2 drivers, were killed. Fisher and his partners were devastated. The decision was made to repave the track with 3.2 million 10-pound bricks, improving safety for drivers and spectators alike. In doing so, they also provided the speedway with its famous nickname, the Brickyard. The tragedy also got Fisher thinking about the poorly constructed roads people traveled on every day. He understood that the continued growth of automobile sales and the headlamps he manufactured depended on the public's confidence in the safety of motorized travel. He also knew automobile owners longed to drive far beyond the limits of their home cities to far-off destinations. Never one to think small, Fisher conceived his most outrageous idea yet. He would build a paved highway spanning the country from coast to coast. Fisher had nowhere near the means necessary to undertake such a monumental project alone. By his own estimate, construction would cost $10 million, about $260 million in today's money. The projection would prove to be laughably miscalculated. Still, Fisher hoped the project could be financed entirely by the automobile industry and private contributions. To that end, he called together a large group of his prominent friends to unveil his idea at a dinner party in Indianapolis in 1912. Fisher's plan called for a highway of crushed rock stretching from New York City's Times Square to San Francisco's Lincoln Park. Its purpose, in Fisher's words, was to stimulate as nothing else could the building of enduring highways everywhere that will not only be a credit to the American people, but will also mean much to American agriculture and American commerce. His goal was to complete the highway in time for San Francisco's 1915 World's Fair. A testament to Fisher's sales skills, the reception to his idea was overwhelmingly positive. Goodyear's Frank A. Sieberling wrote a check for $300,000 on the spot. Others pledged smaller amounts. Fisher also received checks from friends Thomas Edison, Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson. Notable for his absence of support was Henry Ford, who steadfastly declared that it was solely government's responsibility to build better roads. Packard Motor Company's president, Henry Joy, sent Fisher a check for $150,000, requesting the highway be named for a man both he and Fisher regarded as a hero. Fisher agreed. The project would be called the Lincoln Highway, after the president who had preserved the Union. Joy was elected president of the Lincoln Highway Association, LHA, the organization responsible for overseeing construction, with Fisher serving as vice president. Still, funding for the Lincoln Highway fell far short of what was needed. A month after presenting his idea, Fisher had collected just $1 million toward his $10 million goal. He needed another strategy and devised a scheme that was both simple and brilliant. The LHA would sponsor the construction of seedling miles along the highway's planned route. Fisher reasoned that when motorists traveled the route and could compare the paved and unimproved sections side by side, they would lobby local officials to finish the dirt portions and connect the whole. The plan worked, at least in areas where taxpayers lived. In sparsely populated areas of the country, particularly out west, there wouldn't be funds to construct vast stretches of the Lincoln Highway for years. There was also the matter of determining the route itself. East of the Mississippi River, the task was easy. Planners could include a number of existing roads that needed only to be widened, paved, and connected. But the western United States was another story. In order to scout the best course, the LHA assembled a team of what were called trailblazers. Their mission was to trek across the vast expanse and identify the most feasible path. The team spent months wandering the countryside and diligently surveying the landscape. Wherever they went, they were greeted by cheering residents and smiling public officials, well aware of the potential economic rewards of their towns being included on the route. In the end, LHA leaders did as leaders often do. They largely ignored the recommendations of their subordinates and simply chose the most direct path possible. Stretching 3,389 miles, the route of America's first transcontinental highway, traced the length of the original Lancaster Turnpike, crossed the Mississippi at tiny Clinton, Iowa, folded in sections of the Mormon Trail, and snaked up and over the Sierra Nevada at the Donner Pass before terminating in San Francisco. Merely marking the official route was no small feat. That task fell largely to the Boy Scouts, who trudged through dense forests, across yawning plains, and up steep mountainsides to post signs bearing the distinctive Lincoln Highway emblem, a vertical rectangle bordered with red on top, blue on the bottom, and bearing a large blue L against white in the middle. A series of bronze statues of Abraham Lincoln was also commissioned to serve as landmarks in key locations. Considering the common delays of road projects today, it should come as no surprise that Fisher's goal for completing the first great American highway was, in a word, optimistic. Vast sections of the Lincoln Highway would remain unconstructed for well over two decades. Yet the highway's signs remained posted, nailed into trees in remote forests, and mounted on poles in the middle of empty prairies, no doubt to the considerable befuddlement of passing hikers and horseback riders. Despite its incomplete state, the Lincoln Highway opened for motorists as work progressed. Suffice it to say, the situation set the stage for some interesting travel experiences. Even the LHA's own 1916 official road guide described a cross-country trip along the Lincoln Highway as something of a sporting proposition. Motorists were advised to plan for a journey of 20 to 30 days and to top off their gas tanks at every opportunity. More revealing, drivers were warned to get out of their cars and wade into any pools of water they encountered to determine the depth before attempting to drive through them. The guide also listed recommended travel accessories, shovel, axe, chains, jacks, cans of spare fuel, tire casings, inner tubes, and a complete set of tools. Firearms were deemed unnecessary, but travelers heading west of Omaha were advised to pack camping equipment. The guide also informed readers that in certain areas, private citizens could be called on for help.
Around Fish Springs, Utah, for instance, stranded travelers were instructed to build a sagebrush fire. Mr. Thomas will come with a team. He can see you 20 miles off. Finally, the guide offered this last bit of advice. Don't wear new shoes. Still, intrepid motorists